In this episode, I get to introduce you to my close friend and colleague, Sean Rafferty. Sean is a personal safety and corporate security professional. We're going to talk about workplace violence, specifically active attacker type situations. It is a very frank and sobering conversation, so buckle up and let's get to it. All right, everybody, before we get into today's topic, I want to remind everybody, if your business is reopening after any kind of closure due to COVID, or you've continued to remain open, but you're struggling with how to mark your facilities to ensure physical distancing and relay important information about safety and health as it relates to COVID, I want you to go visit our friends over at Mighty Line Floor Tape. Mighty Line has some great products for you to mark your floors, whether it be the stand here, the 6 feet distancing, or just floor tape to denote lanes of travel. They have everything you need to mark your facility. So hit the link in the show notes, visit our friends at Mighty Line Floor Tape. They are incredible partners in safety. I can't thank them enough for their support of the podcast. Again, Mighty Line Tape for all of your floor marking needs. All right, we're here with Sean Rafferty. I want you to introduce yourself to the listeners and a little bit about your background specifically, because it's quite interesting.
All right, thanks, Blaine. You know, I really appreciate you having me on. I'm looking forward to recording this. So I've been in the security industry for roughly about 25 years. I started off in the Marine Corps, then I was a corrections officer, then a police officer, and then I went over to work in Kuwait doing force protection work before the war started, and then I managed to get into Iraq, and I worked in Iraq as a security consultant and coordinator doing training of the Iraqi Ministry of Oil Security Force, and then I switched over and started working with Blackwater. So I did that for about 3 or 4 years, working with Blackwater, protecting high-level dignitaries, mostly the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. I left Iraq when my son was born. I started my own martial arts school. I did that for a little bit, but it was right during the 2008 recession. So I had to close it down. I went back over with Blackwater, worked in Afghanistan for a couple more years, Afghanistan and Iraq. Doing the same job, protecting high-level diplomats. And then I left Iraq around 2010, and I started working as a firearms instructor for a little bit, and then I got a job working as a federal agent with the U.S. Department of Commerce, working on the Secretary of Commerce protection detail. So I did that for several years, and then I worked as a physical security specialist. I left the Department of Commerce to work as a physical security specialist, mainly because the travel schedule was too much for my family. So I did that for a little bit. And then I decided to start my own company about 2 years ago. And the name of my company is called SPR Group LLC. And we focus in on developing active shooter protocols, training plans for schools and businesses. So that's basically what I'm doing now.
Nice. So SPR Group, and I know that we've worked together a couple of times, right? So
yes.
We met years ago. Our paths crossed back when I owned my franchise stores. You came and did an assessment. You did the workplace violence training orientation video for all of our workers, and it ended up getting picked up by the franchise, and they were able to use it for all of their units across the country as well. And then I even reconnected with you several years later when I worked for a med device manufacturer and had you come in. It was a new facility that they had opened and had you come in and do another assessment and actually do training for the leadership staff for workplace violence. And you also did the plan, the actual response plan, as well as a law enforcement entry guide. I'll let you get into some of like what these things are and why they're important. And what was interesting to me, and which is what we want to talk about in this episode, was, you know, I had been at other companies, and everyone knows the Run, Hide, Fight video. It's free. It's on YouTube, and people play that, and then you sign off, and it's like, yep, we all got the Run, Hide, Fight training. You know, we checked a box, basically. And maybe they have a one page, here's what you do in the event of an active shooter. You know, you stay in your office, hide under a desk, call 911. If you can get out, go outside. But that's it. So I want my listeners to get something more out of that kind of training. That's just not enough. I mean, it's what you taught me and what I learned from you. So let's start there. Let's start with, okay, basic foundation and building on run, hide, fight. And then, of course, Alice is another topic. We're not dogging on anything, but let's go deeper and challenge my listeners to do better for their workers and their organizations. So start us off. What's involved when we talk about workplace violence and specifically active shooter with training and development?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely correct, and it's very sad. And most organizations, it is a check the box kind of thing. And the sad part of that is, if there ever is an incident, there's going to be a lot of people hurt and injured, and then you have the liability issue, the lawsuits that are going to come around. So you do have to go beyond just the little video that you see, the free source that everybody watches. You also have to take into account the type of employees that you have, because you might have young people there and you might have older people, you know, age groups ranging from 20 to 60 to 70. You can't expect everybody to understand what to do. So you just can't tell somebody, all right, you have to run. So how do you run? How do you hide? How do you fight? Right? So you have to get more in depth into those particular subjects. Some people don't really like the concept or the, you know, run, hide, fight the way it sounds, but you know, I think it pretty much tells exactly what you're going to have to do. And this is another misconception that a lot of people don't think about, is just because it says run, hide, fight doesn't mean you do it in that order. You might start off hiding, then you have to run, and then you have to fight, or any of those combinations. So you have to understand the dynamics that go into play when there is some type of active shooter situation, because unfortunately, the police generally aren't going to arrive in time to help save you, because statistically speaking, most active shooter incidents end before the police arrive. So that means as an employee, as a team member, you're going to have to try to survive on your own until the police arrive. So how do you do that?
What I hear you saying is the first thing we should do is set realistic expectations for our employees. And it starts with mindset, right?
Sure.
Being in the right mind, having the right frame of mind about this topic in general.
Sure. So the mindset that everybody should adopt initially is that no one's coming to save you. So it's up to you to save yourself. Because when an active shooter situation happens and there's a lockdown, people are going to be in their own separate spaces. You know, some people might be congregated in one room together and then you guys can help each other out, but you might be stuck by yourself and you might have to try to figure out how to get out of that building by yourself. So you have to develop that mindset that you're alone, that you're going to have to do everything you need to do to keep yourself alive. And then if you are with somebody, and what if they're hurt? Now you're going to have to, you know, keep yourself alive and help keep them alive. So mindset is critical, because if you don't have the proper mindset, it definitely can create a situation for you where if you're injured or if it doesn't look very good, you might not survive. But if you had the proper mindset, then you can survive a lot of things. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've heard the stories of people that have been injured, like minor injuries, and because they think it's bad, they end up dying. And then you have other people who have a strong will to live, and they have horrific injuries where the doctors still can't believe they lived. It's because of the mindset. You have to want to live. You have to want to survive. You have to want to overcome whatever is in front of you. As a company, a business owner, a leader, somebody in leadership position within the company, you have to look at this in a holistic perspective, right? You have to want to be able to train your people, and you have to be able to, you want to have some type of repetitive training process. You can't just watch one video when somebody gets first hired on, you have them watch a video during orientation, you think that's good. You got to look at it like this. If you ever play sports or you ever do anything that requires muscle memory, like even, you know, when you're using a keyboard, and if you can use a keyboard and not look at the actual, you know, numbers and letters, then you develop muscle memory. But it took you a little while to do that. If you play sports, once you do something enough, you develop muscle memory and you do it automatically. And that's the way you want this to be. You can't just expect to be able to work under stress, like a life and death situation, just because you watched one 30-minute long video. because there's so many dynamics involved.
Yeah, absolutely right. And you know, any safety pros that are listening, you know this. You know this to be true. All I would need to do is point you in the direction of emergency evacuation drills that we do. We do a quarterly, you know, fire drill or something. Those never go well. You've got new hires that just started last week. You've got people that weren't here for the last one, and it's always chaotic. Nobody goes to the right spot. People end up in different spots, and you're planning that. Can you imagine what you're looking at, the scenario you're looking at, if something like workplace violence were to take place, and all you did was show a video as part of their orientation 5 years ago when they started or whatever? But so mindset, having the right expectation, treating this topic with the respect that it needs. So let's get into some of the mechanics. Like, and I know what you did for me when you came out. One is, you know, we all have a map of our facility, probably because of, you know, the fire drill and the tornado shelter in place procedures. But, you know, what do we need to do that goes beyond what you typically find with an evacuation map or shelter in place map? How can we kind of take that, build on it, so that we have a robust workplace violence response plan?
Sure. So basically, flexibility is very important, because you can't be rigid when it comes to something like active shooter situation, because you might have a shooter inside the building, but you always have to assume there might be someone outside as well. So with the typical rally points that you would have during, you know, like a fire type drill or evacuation, you know, that's okay. You have those points and people, you know, congregate over there, you get a head count, make sure everybody's okay. But if you have an active threat outside that potentially is just going to target everybody that actually congregate in those spots, then now you have a problem. So flexibility is so important when you're coming up with the evacuation process when you do have an active shooter situation. So people just got to be prepared to move to different locations than what they normally would during like a fire type drill, a rally point. And I think basically you have to just train people. Like, once you get outside, you're looking for cover, you're looking for a place to go, you're looking around, making sure you don't see any threats. You have to be cognizant of the windows, because maybe the shooter is inside the building and they're going to target you as you're running out of the building. So you have to be looking not only from the building aspect, but also the parking lot, the surrounding area, because terrorists, they use a technique where they'll target one area and then they'll have like a bomb set up or a secondary attack position where they know people will congregate, maybe where the emergency vehicles will respond to, and then they'll set off with a secondary explosion. So you always have to look at tactics. Like, bad guys will utilize military style tactics, or they'll utilize tactics that terrorists have used. So you always, that's a very big concern to me, especially with, if you have a large business and you have a lot of employees. If people do evacuate the building and they all go to the same spots, then if, say, one of the attackers is an actual former employee and they know those spots, then all they have to do is set up a car bomb rig to go off one of those locations. Or, like I said, if there's multiple attackers and the other one could be waiting there and just shoot everybody as they're coming out. So it's a little bit trickier when you're dealing with active shooter as far as evacuation points go. So in my opinion, when you're training people how to evacuate the building, they have to know where all their exits lead to, first of all, because in that type of situation, your exit point might be right next to you, but that might not be a normal fire exit, right? That exit door might lead to another back room, and then you have another exit door that comes out of there. But people should know where those doors lead to, where those exit points lead to, because the last thing you want to do is you're running for your life and you go out some door, but then you wind up in a dead end and you're stuck in some back part of the building that you have no idea how to get out of there. Now you're trapped because the door you just went into is the only way to get out. Now the shooter's coming towards you. So it's very important that people are trained on where all the exit points that they can actually utilize and where every door goes. So that's basically the most important thing.
And we created zones right for the building.
Yes.
And, you know, so that, mostly so that we can share this with law enforcement. Now, law enforcement, they have a very specific job to do when we call them. And, you know, I was surprised to learn this, you know, a while back. When they show up and they've got to clear a building, it takes a long time. They're not there to tend to anybody who's injured or hurt or take a report. They are there to clear a building. They assume everybody is the shooter, right? You could be looking at getting yelled at, guns pointed at you.
Yes.
You know, you could be in a situation you've never been in before, and it's very stressful. So making sure that you know where you are in the building and can, and you have a means of reporting within reason to others, whether it's by radio or cell phone, what zone you're in, staying there, you know, that all that good stuff. But also understanding the layout is something you taught us. Understanding the layout of your building. If you're in a manufacturing environment, there are some pieces of machinery and equipment that provide good cover, not concealment. And then there are other areas like a closed office that cover that provide concealment, meaning that somebody couldn't see you, but it doesn't really protect you against like small arms fire and things like that, like drywall, right? So making sure, like you said, where exits lead to in the layout of your facility, but also, you know, the safest places to be in the facility, it's also important. Even like you said, how do you run and how do you hide? Like, how would you run through a parking lot and where is the best place to hide once you're out there? Well, why don't you share that? Because this is interesting.
Well, let me piggyback on a few things you said. So communication's vitally important. And we're talking about the internal communication that you have amongst the team members. Now, if you have radios, I love radios. Radios are an excellent source of communication, especially during an incident, because you can utilize them in hiding spaces. You don't have to sit by, you know, with a telephone and talk. And also the communication with the responding law enforcement, because this is what a lot of people don't think about. And I was a police officer at one time, so I kind of understand what the situation is. But when the police, 9 times out of 10, the police have never been in your building before. And if you actually work in a large place that has multiple floors and it's, you know, pretty expansive, now you're having police that are arriving on scene that have never been in your building. They're going to be involved in the most stressful event that they've ever been in. They're probably scared and nervous themselves. Now their other police are responding with them, and they probably never worked with those guys. So now they're linking up with one or two or three or four people that they've never worked with on a team basis, and now they're going into an active war situation. Because I consider active shooter situation like going into combat. It's not like a normal law enforcement situation where you pull somebody over, you're stopping a traffic stop and you're talking to them and they pull a gun out and you pull your gun out and you do like a quick draw and you shoot them. You're talking about fighting somebody who knows you're coming, who's going to hide and try to shoot you, and you're going to have to try to move around them while they're shooting at you from a cover position. So you're talking about a combat situation, and you know most police officers aren't trained enough in that. So they're responding, they don't know where they're going. And then if your employees, they don't know how to call 911 properly, and which most people don't, they panic and they just start screaming a bunch of things. That doesn't help the police out, because now they're responding to a building they don't know where they're going. And all they know is that there's a shooter in the building. They don't really know if there's a guy who has a rifle or a handgun. They don't know the location of the shooter. Now you have a building that's massive, and they are not, like you said, they are not going to run in there and sprint in there and try to find you, because they can get ambushed themselves. So they're going to go slow. They're going to go methodical. They're going to try to go towards the sound of the gunfire. That's why communication is so important, that if you can narrow the instructions down and be more specific on how to get them into the right spot, and that's where internal communication comes into play. So if you know, team members all around the building that are in hiding spots or whatever, if they're communicating via the radio, and then you have one focal or maybe one or two people that are responsible for talking to 911 directly during the whole incident, then you can relay important information while it's going on. So basically, I'll give you an example. If you have 5 doors in your building, and the main driveway entrance that comes into where your building is located at, maybe you have like a rear door. So as soon as the police come on to your property, that rear door is going to be the first one. Let's just say the shooter's on the inside of that area, maybe on that side of the building. Well, that would be good information to relay. Like, hey, as soon as you get on the property, there's a rear exit door. It's not locked, or it is locked, or it's probably going to be open because we hit the alarm and they unlock or whatever. You know, come in that door because the shooter is going to be closer to that side versus going all the way down to the front of the building, which is going to take you more and more minutes to get to where the shooter is located at. So communication is important, internal, external. Understanding what the police have to go through, because you're dealing with police, like I said, they've never been in the building. They probably haven't trained together. They're probably not very experienced, tactically speaking, and they're going into the worst situation in their life. They know it's going to be bad, and they're scared. And, you know, just all you got to do is look on the news to all the active shooter situations that have happened in businesses and schools to, you know, see what I'm talking about.
All great. Great stuff on communication, and it's key. And I think that's shocking for a lot of people to, if they haven't heard it, you know, it's got to sink in. It can take a long time for them to clear that building. And you're right. That could be the first time they've ever set foot there. But what about like when you,
can I piggyback on that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah.
You also mentioned it too. Like you can't expect them to help you out when they come in because their job is to clear, you know, make it safe. Now, some agencies, they have tactical medics, they're called, and they'll have, you know, firefighters that are medics that come in kind of almost right behind the main first law enforcement guys. And they, you know, they wear body armor and they're trained in that. But some departments don't have that and they won't allow medics into the building until the area is secure. So that means if it takes 2 hours to secure that building and you've been shot and you're bleeding out, it might be a long time before someone comes to you. So we can get into that later on and talk about first aid.
Absolutely.
Let's go into the hiding. So if you're going to hide in a room, a conference room or whatever, you have to understand the concept of cover and concealment, and you have to understand the power and capabilities of firearms. Because if you watch the movies, a lot of times you think you're going to be inside of a room and the bullets won't go through the walls. Well, bullets will go through drywall. So you have to understand the room that you're hiding in. So you might go in a conference room that's maybe has glass or drywall, and you might be able to lock the door, and that might stop the guy from kicking the door in, you know, temporarily, but they could shoot through the door and they could shoot through the wall. So you have to understand that just because you're hiding doesn't mean you're safe, because they can still shoot into the room. And this is another tidbit of statistical information, that there hasn't been one incident where an active shooter has kicked in an actual locked door to go inside and shoot everybody in the room. Most of the time, the doors are unlocked. But a lot of times they shoot into the room. So just be cognizant of that. If you do hide in a room, try to get behind something in there that's you know, pretty thick. So if there's a desk in there or a bookshelf, you know, try to hide behind that, get low.
So let's start with what you just said. You know this is what you do. The data from school shootings, for example, the shooter is known to the school. So when we talk about the workplace, it's same is true there. Statistically, it's an insider threat. It's somebody who's associated in some way with that place of business. It's an estranged spouse or a former coworker or a current worker, but they probably have some knowledge, basic knowledge, if not intimate knowledge of the layout of the place, and they're opportunistic, meaning they're really there just to create as much damage as possible. So a locked door, barricaded door, they tend to not waste a lot of time with that. Is that what that is? Is that what I heard you say?
Yes, because, and yes, that's true, because you, even though the police, historically speaking, might not arrive in time to stop the shooter, but the shooter definitely knows that they only have a few minutes to carry out what they need to do. So they have to hurry up. So they're not going to sit there and waste 2 to 3 minutes, 2 to 3 to 4 minutes trying to kick a door open when they can continue on their shooting spree.
So concealment is critical. It's just important to know what it is and is not. It's not cover. So what's cover?
Well, okay. So concealment is basically being able to hide from view, but it doesn't protect you against gunfire. Whereas conceal or cover is not only hiding from the view, but also will give you a certain amount of protection from the gunfire. So you might be in a situation where you use concealment to get to cover. Or use cover, then concealment, then cover, you know, as you're trying to evacuate to get out of the location.
So use the example of a parking lot for that. Like, what are you talking about? Like being able to go from concealment to cover to concealment to get further away, And this is a great tip you trained some leadership folks that I worked with on how to, when once you're outside into the parking lot, this is the correct way to move through the parking lot.
Sure. So like I mentioned earlier, always assume there's more than one shooter. So always assume that there's another guy waiting for you as soon as you get out in the parking lot. So once you break that barrier, that door, do a pregnant pause, get out of the doorway, maybe get on the side of the wall, get low, look around, and know exactly where you're going to go. So before you break that door, you should have it in your mind where you're going to go. And this piggybacks on what I was saying about understanding where these exits, you know, where these doors go out to. So if this means, you know, when you're on your lunch break or whatever, if you want to walk around your building and kind of get an idea, you know, where everything is, this is where this will come into play. So once you break that barrier, take that pregnant pause, make sure where you had in your mind that you're going to go, that everything's good to go. So things you could use as cover. If vehicles are always in the parking lots, right? Obviously, that's what a parking lot is. The best point on a vehicle to hide behind to protect you from gunfire is the front engine block. So if you have to get low, get behind the engine block and that front tire. That'll give you an excellent amount of cover, or actually cover and concealment from gunfire. And we're talking high caliber weapons here. We're not just talking about 9mm. We're talking about rifle rounds as well. So if you get behind the front engine
vehicles.
Block. Yeah. So if you get behind the engine block and you put your legs right behind the tire, that'll give you some protection because remember the bullets can skip under the car as well. So that tire will give you some amount of protection. And I'll tell you a little quick story. I was in Kuwait and I was on force protection, and that's basically like an MP, like a military police kind of position. And then we had a report of a shooting that happened right outside of one of our gates. So I was on a roving patrol in a vehicle. So at first it wasn't a shooting as reported. It was a car accident. So that goes back to what I was saying about how important 911 is, knowing what to say, because 9 times out of 10, what the police initially get from the dispatcher is completely different when they arrive on scene. So if you can give them the accurate information right off the bat, that's the best thing. So I was coming to an active scene where I thought it was a car accident, but it turned out to be a shooting. So I come up on the scene, which could have gotten me killed if the shooter was still on site. Because I wasn't thinking there was a shooter. I was thinking it was an accident. So my mindset was different. So I get out of the vehicle and there was, it was an SUV. And the vehicle was kind of like stopped on a curve. So basically what happened was these two American contractors stopped at a light. And there was a Kuwaiti armed with an AK-47 that was about 20 feet away, like on a berm on the side of the road. He shot 14 rounds through the passenger door, killing the passenger. The bullets went through the door, went through the body of the passenger, and then hit the driver, and he was wounded pretty bad in the chest and legs, I think. And the bullets went through him, out his door, and then, so that's how powerful like an AK-47 is.
So door panels, the trunk, that's probably not the best place.
Nope, not the best. I mean, that's good. That's good concealment, but it's not cover. So, like in the movies, you'll see it all the time. You know, they'll be shooting a high power rifle at a car, but in reality, it's like Swiss cheese. So, but the engine block will give you some protection. So basically, if you're exiting out the door and you got your parking lot, try to run behind that engine block. You might have to get low. There's also telephone poles and light poles that you can get behind. You want to get low. And like I said before, you might have to use concealment initially before you can get to some good cover. But you always want to look and see where you're going, have a plan in mind where you're going to be going. You just don't want to run out of a door blindly, and then that's not really good because there could be a guy waiting for you, and you don't know where you're going, and you could be running right into another attack.
And so, let's say you get out of the building, and you get to a vehicle, the nearest vehicle. You get down, you look around. And then you want to move to another view. You want to get further away, right?
Sure.
Is there a pattern you follow? Do you just go straight? Do you want to go directly away? You know where I'm going with this, right? We would call this getting off the X, but do you want to go straight away from the building? Is it better to go at an angle? Do you want to zigzag? What's your recommendation?
I mean, it just depends. Like if you're actively being shot at, then you want to go at angles, like zigzagging, they call it, because it's harder to hit a moving target. But if you're not being actively shot at, and you can hear the gunfire inside the building, but you don't hear any gunfire outside. And I don't, I think it's also important, now that we're talking about that, that if you never heard what gunfire sounds like, you need to go out and go shoot a gun. But when you're getting shot at, it's different than that initial sound you hear, like firecrackers and things like that. When you're getting shot at, it sounds like a crack going by you. So if you hear a crack sound, and it's not that...
In the air. It's in the air, and it goes by past you.
Yep. So if you hear a crack sound, then you're getting shot at. And plus, if you can see the bullets hitting the ground or skipping off a car, then you definitely know you're getting shot at. So if you're not getting actively shot at or nothing's going on around you, then you could just kind of go more in a straighter line. You want to keep low. But like I said, you always, before you move, you want to make sure you know where you're going and you commit to it. So if you're going to go to that car that's 50 feet away from you, you just start sprinting to that car and you don't stop. And if you are actively getting shot at, and maybe where you're hiding at temporarily and you got some cover, but now the bad guy's shooting at you directly, and maybe your cover's not so great because now the bullets are kind of getting closer to you, then you might have to move. Then that's when the zigzag situation comes into play. You stay low, move at angles, don't stop in the open, try to get to that other point of cover or concealment as quickly as possible.
So let's move on to the next phase here, which we alluded to earlier, and that is, talk about, you say combat, medicine, traumatic first aid, whatever word you want to use. And a lot of our listeners, right, they have first aid teams, they provide first aid CPR training. And I'm just going to, not to go down this rabbit hole, I'll save it for another episode, but I'm going to just go out on a limb and assume most first aid CPR training programs that, especially in the industrial environment, that are performed, do not even meet the basic OSHA standard. Yeah, they meet the American Heart Association or the American Red Cross program, and you got the card, but if you read the OSHA standard, it says you have to train for first aid. You have to train to the injuries that are likely to occur based on the facility, your place of employment. So if you've got a lot of hydraulic machinery, if you've got a lot of, electrical hazards or things like that, you have to be training on how to deal with those types of injuries. So switching back to this topic, this is an opportunity to bolster and improve your first aid training for your first aid team or your safety team that you have, right? So let's talk about traumatic first aid. Just real quick, what are like a couple of things that they should include in the training that will be helpful in a situation like this?
Well, let me give some framework real quick, because what I see is you have to be realistic. Like, you have to think about in terms of realistically what's going to happen. So if you have like first aid kits stationed throughout your building, like in a, in a container on the side of the wall that you could just grab real quick and, fix somebody up, or you have your first aid teams that will run out, somebody, gets their finger cut off or something like that. Well, in an active shooter situation, you're not going to have people running to you. It's not like a combat medic. So you're going to have to treat yourself. And if that particular first aid kit is in another, on the opposite side of the building, because that's where it's located at, well, you can't get to it because maybe the shooter's over in that area and you're wounded. So what are you going to do? So this is where going a little bit beyond what the requirements are, which is the way I think the mindset should be, just because, OSHA says, okay, you have to just have the basic, first aid. Well, you might be shot and you might be bleeding out. So you have to teach somebody how to stop the bleeding. So, apply pressure, doing improvised tourniquets, or maybe if you can, if you had the budget, supply everybody with some type of commercial grade tourniquet, show them how to put the tourniquet on, how to use commercial grade tourniquets as well as improvised tourniquets, because you might be in a situation where you might be in a room with a couple of people and you might have multiple people in there that are wounded and that are bleeding out, and you have to put some improvised tourniquets on because maybe you only have one tourniquet in there. So the biggest thing is being realistic about your medical kits, like where they're positioned at, and realize you're probably not going to be able to get to them. And then what do you have inside the kits? Like, do you really have anything in there that's going to be good for traumatic injuries like gunshots or knife injuries? Do you have pressure bandages in there? Do you have tourniquets? Do you have quick clot? Do you have things like that they can use? Because there's a lot of kits that aren't. I mean, I've been in a couple of federal buildings, you it blow your mind just thinking how they just really aren't prepared for that.
I'll throw one out there. This is a quick tip. I thought about this, Sean, after the last time we worked together, and that is a lot of businesses today, a ton of businesses today, they give you an ID card. And what do they usually give you with that? You got to put it somewhere. You got to wear it on your person.
Yeah.
So they give you a lanyard.
Yep, lanyard, yep.
A great tip is most of them are breakaway, right? So you just yank it off your neck. If you're bleeding, teach them how to use that lanyard to wrap it around an arm or a leg and tie it to stop or slow the bleeding and then get to another location. But being creative, like you said, sometimes you have to, they're not going to have a kit on them. So improvised devices are probably going to save their life in that case. So that's a tip for people. Take a look at what your employees typically always have on them. A belt is a good example, but not everybody wears a belt. But if everyone wears a lanyard, you know, look for a lanyard that's long enough, strong enough, and maybe the lanyard is wide enough, not real spaghetti lanyard, but like a wider one that you're thinking, if I needed to use this in, you know, a traumatic first aid event, I want this to be, you know, functional. So there, I don't know, there's a tip, but that's like some stuff that we think of, right? That comes to mind.
That's you're absolutely correct. And you just have to realize that the improvised tourniquet is not, it's a temporary solution that'll help slow the bleeding down for that paramedic to arrive. And you got to remember, you know, you might be stuck there for a couple hours waiting. So teach them how to apply these improvised tourniquets. And, you know, like I'll give you an example. You use a belt or even a shirt. You stick something hard in it, like a pencil or maybe a screwdriver or something like that, and you put that in the knot and you twist it to make it tight. But it's and another thing too is if you train how to, you know, apply tourniquets, you have to show people how to do it to somebody else, and you also have to show them how to do it with only one arm, like they can only use one arm because they might be injured, their other arm might be injured. And another pro tip, if you do have tourniquets in the med kits, don't have it in a plastic bag that they came in from the wherever you bought them from. Automatically take them out of the bag, have them adjusted to where they can fit over a leg, and then you can wrap it up and put a rubber band around it. So that way, all you got to do is grab it real quick, and you know the rubber band will break off, and you stick it, put it right over the leg, and always go high and tight. So always go as high as you can. Even if he's got an injury like in his calf muscle, go all the way up to his groin. Just go as high as you can. And it's not like in the movies, you know, you can have a tourniquet on your arm for hours and it's not going to do any damage to you. And that's been battle proven. So don't worry about that whole thing where you're going to lose blood flow and you're going to get you'll be fine. So
good stuff. So what I hear is expand training. First aid training to beyond just a first aid team or your safety team. Offer it to everybody that you can offer it to if you have a budget for that and you're able to. Everybody should know this. Make sure that you have adequate supplies, not just in strategic locations, but make sure people know how to access them, and make sure you add some improvised first aid approaches to the training program. So going back to what we started with on this topic, go beyond the basic community first aid CPR, folks. It's not going to get you where you need to be. And when we're talking about, let alone workplace violence, just industrial hazards you're likely to see. So make sure you do that. So we talked about calling 911 a little bit. We talked about run, hide, fight, and cover, and concealment, and you know some things that you would have to expect. And we talked about traumatic first aid. What about interacting with law enforcement? So historically, a little history lesson. You know, it used to be when you had an event like this that they would arrive, they would lock down the area from outside, they wouldn't let anybody leave, and then they would wait for the special team to show up, right, that had training. Maybe it's in the next county, maybe it's a city large enough like LA, they have their own team. But now,
yeah, SWAT team.
Yeah. What they've learned with the school shootings is that event is going on while they're waiting. So now they go in right away. They don't do that anymore. So, and that gets to what you were saying about it might be the first time that they've been there. It may be a new officer. They're new to this area, this jurisdiction. They're new to that shift, and they haven't worked with the other officers that they're going in with. What can an employer do reaching out with local law enforcement to at least not, they're not going to eliminate that possibility of that risk, but at least, you know, get some level of comfort with the responders.
Yeah, sure. And you're absolutely correct. So build that relationship up with the district, police district that handles where your building's at. Invite them over. Obviously, when you have, you know, you might have, if, depending on the hours of your business operations, so if you're 24 hours, then you're going to have 3 to 4 different shifts of different police officers, right, that work during that time. So the most efficient way, in my opinion, that you can educate them is if you maybe make a little training video or some type of printed document that you can basically show the outline of your building, like a map, have pictures of the different entry points and, you know, whatever you could show them, but, you know, don't overdo it. Just make it really small because or short and sweet, the information, as detailed as possible, have a phone list of the, you know, the different leadership that are there and maybe an overview of what your procedures are going to be, like what you've trained them to do and, you know, that type of thing. And then what they can do is hopefully if they have the time, they can maybe run by that, you know, periodically throughout the month during roll call. Because, you know, when police come on shift, they have what is called roll call the first 10 or 15 minutes and they, you know, talk about various things before the police officers go out and do their work. So this, you know, this could be a time when the supervisor can go, okay, hey, we're going to talk about, you know, this particular office building, and this is what it looks like, and these are the main entry points, and this is their standard operating procedure for what they're going to do if there's an active shooter thing, blah, blah, blah. And that way, it enables all the officers in every shift to be able to see what, at least have some eyes on about the layout of the building a little bit. And if they do this enough, maybe do this at least once or twice a month, and that's a good thing. Another thing you could do is you can actually invite them, say, hey, if you wanna use our parking lot to come over and write your reports up, you know, you can go ahead and, you know, if you want to come in and grab some coffee while we're here, you can. No worries. And that way, at least you're building up a rapport with those police officers and they're kind of getting to know the layout of your building. But what it also does too is it'll show like, if there is somebody that maybe has an intention to attack your building, or maybe one of the coworkers intending to do something, but there's always a police officer showing up or just at different times and just showing up to say hi or out in the parking lot, it might be just enough to where it'll stop somebody from wanting to attack there, because if they never know when the police officer is going to be there, then they might not decide to do it. Because remember, they only have a few minutes. So if there's an actual armed police officer right outside the parking lot, they might not want to do it at all because it's not going to be worth it to them.
And you just hit on one of the most valuable but under-referenced or mentioned benefits of doing this not once a year, not once every other year, but quarterly, different shifts, and just being active as a safety professional, just constantly being vigilant on this, right? One of the most unspoken benefits is what you just said. You know, on this podcast, we talk with safety pros all the time, right? And I'm going to talk to the audience real quick here. And we're always talking about building a culture of safety. We're always talking about being visible, walking the walk, engagement, and all that good stuff. This is a great example where 99.9% of your population will see this and feel better about the place where they work, that they're being cared for, taken care of, or you get the safety committee involved and, you know, hosting the fire, EMS, and police department on visits and things like that. The thing that Sean just mentioned is huge. It could be yet another deterrent that you don't realize that somebody is seeing this. And anybody who had any kind of notion to pull something off, they're not getting along with their coworkers, they didn't like their last performance review or whatever, and, you know, they're otherwise not right, this is something that may deter them. So make it visible. Make it a public spectacle that this is what we're doing to protect you and keep you safe. So don't do it, you know, in secret, and do it when the least amount of people are there because it's the least, you know, convenient for everybody. Make sure that you get some bang for your buck when you go, you know, go into these activities. And and get as many people involved as possible. Well,
so this is going to be enlightening to your audience that I was working at a federal agency and we did an active shooter exercise and then we had a debriefing and we had one of the local police officers there when we were talking about all these things. But this police officer, now mind you, this was in the greater D.C. area and, you know, right outside of Washington, D.C. So you would think that the budgets for the police officers are a lot higher, the training, and it's so close to the federal government that there's all kinds of resources they could use. But this police officer made a very interesting thing. They said, well, we've got the active shooter situation handled with the schools. We got that down. But the businesses, on the other hand, that's another issue. We're still kind of a little iffy on that. So think about that for a second. And if your business is located in a smaller town, smaller city that doesn't have a big police department, a big budget, imagine the type of training that those officers are getting. So this goes back to what I said from the very onset, a mindset, having the proper mindset that you're going to have to survive on your own. Because these police officers showing up, you have no idea what their training level is. So they have so many obstacles in front of them. And can I recommend a movie that everybody can kind of watch to understand the response of the police officers of how bad it can go?
Yeah, yeah, I know what you're going to say. This is a good one. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you have Amazon, check out, it's called Inside Building 13. It's about the Parkland shooting at school in Florida. It's an outstanding example of how, if there would have been communication involved with that, the teachers would have had handheld radios, there could have been lives saved. If they would have communicated properly to the responding officers, there could have been lives saved. I mean, there's so many failure points that were shown in this movie. So I would advise you to watch it. And then if you're a supervisor, think of that on the levels and how you can compare that to your building and what you guys are prepared for, because you cannot assume anything. All right. That's a failure point that I see in a lot of places. They assume all these things. And then when something goes bad, it's going to go bad. And you have to have all kinds of plans in place. You just can't have one plan.
Murphy's always on the job, brother.
Yep. And your medical kit, your high-speed medical kit that you have locked up in one of the rooms or, you know, in the break room down, you know, in the middle of the building, guess what? No one's going to get to it. So there goes your plan on trying to get first aid. There goes your plan on having your medical team running out to help people. Nope. So, you know, you got to have other plans, realistic plans of what's really going to happen. And if you as a supervisor, a safety professional, think of your workplace violence plan on what you're going to do. If you think of it on those terms of realistically what could happen, you're going to be a lot better off when you're training your people.
You're absolutely right. And to my audience, another way to think about this is we talk about confined space entry. We talk about emergency response for injuries and the jurisdiction where your business is located. A lot of businesses, you know, it starts with real estate. Every business, like, we have to build a plant and it's real estate. And you're going to go where real estate is affordable. You have the room, the space that you need. It's not like you're going to be right next to the precinct and the fire department and EMS and across the street from the hospital. You're probably going to be out in an area that is nearby some, you know, a workforce population that you can pull from and hire from, but not too close, right? Not in the middle of a city, but you're going to be out where it's affordable and it may be an all-volunteer fire department and EMS. And the police department may only have so many people, so many officers on duty at a time. So what Sean is saying is absolutely crucial, not just a plan for yourself, but your plan should take into account the likely response or lack thereof through no fault of their own. So your plan should be adjusted to that as well. So the Parkland shooting was an absolute tragedy on many levels. And what I want to end this episode with is, you know, we talked a lot about responding to an active shooter or workplace violence, you know, when, you know, planning for when it occurs. And, you know, go watch that movie. It is heartbreaking to see and learn about all the different failures and breakdowns in that event. But one I want to end on is one failure and breakdown, which is not seeing or acknowledging that this was going to happen to begin with. Let's end this episode on some tips. What can employers, workers, coworkers pay attention to? What could be potential signs of, and you know, you and I have talked about this a lot, of like before that even happens, there are things that you probably missed.
Sure. Yeah. You know what? You read my mind because that's exactly what I was going to mention. You know, prevention is so important, and being preventative, putting preventative measures in place can actually either stop an incident from happening or mitigate the damage. And, you know, one of the prevention tools is, like I was saying, having the police officers come over, you know, and then all the other security measures you put in place. But actively train your employees and your leadership on what to look for. So if you have one of your employees is having marital problems, okay? You know, what is this guy saying? What is this girl saying when they're at work? Because if, say, you have a woman and her husband, and they're having problems, and the woman's actually the employee, well, he can decide to come into to work to get her, right, and shoot her and then start shooting everybody else. Or it could be somebody that just has a problem with another coworker, and they decide to shoot that particular coworker and just go on a shooting spree and shoot everybody else. I mean, we've seen these incidents. So just because somebody's having an incident at work is one thing, but also they might have some serious problems outside of work that bring that problem to the workplace. So look at, what are people saying? How are they acting? What are they talking about? What's going on outside of work? Are they having some serious issues? What is... you know, Jane or John talking about? What are they being threatened by their significant other? Are they being threatened by somebody else? Look for those types of signs. You know, what are people saying? You know, and then you have to look at the individual themselves. Do you have an employee that normally is a talkative type person, and all of a sudden they're not talking anymore? They're very gloom. And then you find that, and then you hear like, okay, maybe they're having some issues at home. And then maybe they're getting aggressive. Maybe they're being threatening. You know, you have to take those threats serious. And I don't mean go overboard, but just kind of be educated about what they're saying, and then take it to heart. Because oftentimes people don't listen, or they don't pay attention to what's plainly right in front of them. And every single active shooter, every single one of them that's ever happened, they've always talked about it. They've always gave some kind of warning sign of what they were going to do. You know, every single one of them. So just pay attention to what people are saying. Pay attention to body language. You know, what kind of, I mean, if you're working around the same people 40 hours a week, you know, for 5 years straight, you pretty much know what that person's like. So if all of a sudden they're doing things totally, completely out of character, take note of that, because those are just warning signs.
So you talked to me, this was a while back. You probably don't even remember this conversation, but it stuck with me because I look for this stuff now, right? So we were talking, and you mentioned something about, like, sometimes in preparation for somebody doing something, and there have been cases that you could probably refer to, but some folks will, like, they'll go out of the wrong exit, like, just to see what would happen, like, when they go leave that day, right? They'll go out the emergency exit door out the back just to see what would happen. Or they try to bring a backpack in or something just to see, like, there'll be nothing in it, just to see if somebody will stop them and say, hey, like, maybe you have security up front or something like that. They'll start to, like, stress test the protocols that are in place to kind of exploit them to test it out.
Yeah. So you mentioned before, the biggest threat is the internal threat. So as a safety professional or leadership, maybe what you could do is you could change certain things, like periodically randomly change things. Like if people open a door up and they prop it open and they go out and they do a smoke break, well, maybe what you could do is get alarms set in those doors, and then you start setting those alarms. You don't tell anybody about it. And then, maybe you hire a security guard to check bags. Periodically check bags. You know, you let everybody know this is what we're doing. And then that way, if you change the plan up, then it's going to be harder for somebody to be able to plan an attack out. Because if they plan on, you know, they come into work, check everything out, and they park their car in the back of the building, and that's where all the guns are located at, and they're going to wait till a certain point in the work day when everybody's there, and they're going to go prop open that back door because it's not alarmed, nobody's back there, and they're going to go grab their guns, and they're going to come back in, and they're going to shoot everybody. Well, if now that door is alarmed, or if they don't know if it's alarmed, or if they don't know all these different things, then guess what? Their whole planning process is going to be chaotic. They're not going to be able to plan it out. They're not going to be able to adjust for anything. But if you're doing the same thing all the time, the same process, and that person's been there 2 years straight and they're doing the same thing and they never change, guess what? It's easy to plan then. But that's one way that you can throw a potential attacker off by just mixing it up. And guess what? It doesn't cost you anything.
Nice. So safety professionals, you all need to either partner with your security team and leadership team. You're an integral part. Partner with HR for everything Sean was talking about on like how to properly report some concerns that you see about behavior or the way people are talking. You know, you're going to need to go through HR. HR needs to be on board. Everybody needs to think of themselves, just like we say in safety. Safety is everyone's responsibility. So too is security. So think of yourself and your teams as security teams. So Sean, you know, we've been talking for so long about this that it's like insane that I finally get to mention it. For my listeners who want to learn more about personal safety as well as, you know, security at work, there's a new place where people can go to get this information. And where is that?
Thank you once again. Finally got my podcast up and going. It's been a labor of love and something I've been wanting to do for a long time. And the name of the podcast is called the Security Pro Podcast.
There you go. The Security Pro Podcast. My listeners should be able to remember the name of that podcast.
Yep. I wonder who helped me come up with a name, but no, I thought it was because you're the safety pro and I could be the security pro, but I think it's, I'm on iTunes, Spotify, and other channels. I'm still kind of learning how that process works. So
yeah,
basically
we're talking all the time about it. Yeah.
Yep. So basically on my podcast, I get into the more in-depth stuff about as an individual, how to react during incidences and how to avoid situations. So I'll cover everything from school active shooting, the, you know, workplace and church and just individual things. And my plan is to really make it to where if you listen to the shows, you'll learn something every time.
And my audience needs to hit subscribe on the Security Pro Podcast because it is an integral part of keeping people safe at work. And also the things that you talk about, we can learn, we can take home, you know, in our daily lives with our loved ones. And that's key. And you know, on the Safety Pro Podcast community site for premium members, Sean is sharing with us a series of videos on this very topic, breaking them all down so that you can use these as training for your businesses to keep your employees safe. So Safety Pro community premium members can get access to those videos. We got the first four that are going to be available. Sean, I can't thank you enough for coming on. We're going to do another couple episodes. You know that, right? We're going to have to make this a thing. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love talking about this. I love helping people out. And can I just add one more thing real quick?
Anything.
As remember, training is key. You got to do continual training with your people. You can't just do one 30-minute video that they only saw one time in 5 years. You got to do it all the time. And you got to do run drills if you can. And, you know, video-based training is probably one of the easiest ways to do it because you can have them do it from home or whatever. And then little micro drills, little small little physical drills that you could do where you can pull a few people out at a time and cover specific topics. And then, you know, eventually you could do like a full-blown exercise if you have the time and capabilities. But training's hugely important. And that's the only way that people are going to be able to function under a stressful situation like an active shooter. But I look forward to being able to, you know, talk with you more on, you know, future episodes. So
absolutely. And that's key. You summed it up exactly. That's what we aim to do with the Safety Pro Podcast. But that's also what my listeners can get from the Security Pro Podcast as well, is this continuous professional development, tips, ideas, concepts, things that the expectation is you don't just listen and go, oh, yeah, that's an odd curiosity. No, You need to take this stuff that we're talking about and you need to go into the workplace and you need to make it happen. And so we're here to help provide that information and that support for you. Go to the Security Pro Podcast, hit subscribe. Also, make sure you go to the Safety Pro Podcast community page. It's free to join as a member. We have a lot of information on the free side. And of course, for $6.99 a month, you can get access to this premium content, training videos, professional development videos. We got an entire series for consultants. We're launching a series for safety professionals as well. And now we have a set of videos from Sean on security in the workplace as well, specifically workplace violence. So make sure you check that out. And Sean, I can't thank you enough for finally getting together and doing this. You know, as often as we talk during the week, we should just be hitting record half of the time. You know that, right? Because it's good stuff.
I know. Yeah, I'd probably be a lot more fun, more humorous. But you can also find me on my website at sprgroupsolutions.com. And there kind of gives you a little more in-depth thing of what I do and about my background. And then if you ever need to contact me about anything, if you got some questions, you know, I'd love to help you out. Just, you know, whatever way I can help you, just look me up that way. But anyway, yeah, I look forward to doing another however many shows you want to do. We can make this an ongoing thing.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we're going to. We've known each other for I don't know how many years it's been now, but it's good stuff. So yeah, it has. All right, Sean, thank you, brother. I really appreciate the wisdom you dropped on us today. And we'll touch base and we'll set up another podcast episode to talk about another topic that's related to the workplace, but on the security side.
Sure. I can't wait.
All right. Thanks. There you go. My conversation with Sean. He's such a great friend and I'm so glad to see him doing something in this space. It's something that we desperately need more focus on in workplace safety as safety professionals. And go ahead and check out more about Sean at sprgroupsolutions.com. Head over to the Safety Pro Podcast community page to get more information about Sean and see posts from him. He is a premium member at the Safety Pro Podcast community. So I want you to get to know him some more and head over there and check out what we have going on there as well. And I will talk to you on the next Safety Pro Podcast episode.